From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. After 15 years of calling himself African-American, the linguist John McWhorter says no more. From now on, he's black. Such naming and renaming is nothing new. After World War I, there was a fight to replace colored with the word Negro with a capital N. A half century later, the term black, once negative, became infused with pride. By the late 80s, black leaders declared a new name, African-American. It underscored ethnicity rather than race and connected people in the U.S. to the continent where their ancestors were torn from their homes and forced into slavery centuries ago. But as the number of people moving here from Africa has tripled, a new debate's underway about who's really African-American. The politics of language identity, the meaning behind a name, is next on The Connection. First, the news. Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. We like to name things. It's how we learn to communicate. It's the way parents teach their children to speak, naming objects. We like to name people as well, not just with their given names, but with words that distinguish them from others. Someone might be British. Someone else is Asian. Someone else is blonde or dark-skinned. And if you follow the news, you'll notice there's a lot of it today. We talk about Muslims and Arabs and Afghans and Jews and Iraqis and so on. And it's a search for precision in the language that leads us to today's story. What is an African-American? Is it a black woman living in Chicago, or is it the son of a Nigerian business executive who happens to have a U.S. passport? Maybe the name fits both. The confusion in terms has led one leading intellectual to say, enough. John McWhorter says the words African-American don't fit him anymore, and McWhorter's commentary, Why I'm Black, Not African-American, has crystallized a debate over the use of names and terminology. And we'd like to invite you this hour to weigh in on the meaning of names and the politics behind identity. Do you make a distinction between the words black and African-American? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with us this hour is John McWhorter. He's a linguist and senior fellow in public policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He's joining us from the NPR studios in New York. John, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks. Hi.
Did something change in your mind recently to bring you to this commentary?
I've never really liked the term African-American, but you have to pick your battles, and so I started going along with it in about 1990. But it's come to my attention these days, just through empirical experience, that there are a great many immigrants from Africa among us these days. The number of them apparently almost tripled in the 90s. And these are people who are African-American. They speak African languages. They speak English with an accent. They are rooted in the dance, dress, and culinary traditions of Africa. They're only half American, just like Mexican Americans, etc. And there is a growing discomfort among many black American descendants of slaves with the idea of those immigrants calling themselves African-American. And we're even hearing from people as highly placed as Alan Keyes that African-American should only be black Americans who are descendants of slaves because we're supposed to use that term to convey that we've suffered in this country. And as far as I'm concerned, that's, for one thing, it's small. And for another thing, it doesn't really make any logical sense. And then it got me to thinking that all these years I've thought that this African-American idea was a little odd because not only am I not African in any meaningful way, but no black American descendant of slaves is, no matter how quote-unquote black we want to say that they are.
Now, was it about actually being African, or was it about finding a word or a term or an acknowledgement about history that led to African-American? We'll be talking later in the program with Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jackson, who's one of the people who likes the term and pushes it and still does. But I'm wondering, John, you make a point in your essay that I wonder if you can repeat for us by telling us your full name and why that's important. Can you take us through that?
Yeah. My full name is John Hamilton McWhorter V. I am the fifth person with that name. All the John Hamilton McWhorters lived right here in the United States, and they did all kinds of things, most of them very humble things, but noble in their way. And they were here. They were not African men. And it seems to me that if we call ourselves African, what we're implying is that our history right here, which is now a 400-year history, is somehow not enough, something that we need to kind of gloss over, and that the only way that we can feel good about ourselves is to remind ourselves of this African heritage. And I've always felt that it was kind of a dissing, so to speak, of my ancestors who were very American people. They weren't white. Black people are not white. I'm not going to do one of those arguments about we are all Americans. This is not Ralph Ellison here. But we are a kind of American. And I'm saying that not because I think that we all need to come together and all of that. I'm saying it because it's the only thing that makes sense. And if we're going to be proud of ourselves, we should be proud of something real. Kente cloth is not real for me, Jesse Jackson, or any other black American.
But if we go back to the four John Hamilton McWhorters who preceded you, there would have been among that crowd or that group people who lived with the word color, people who lived with the word Negro, people who saw the introduction of the word black, and then in your lifetime the introduction or the embracing of the word African American. Why the difficulty in fixing on one that seems to work?
Well, I think that the term black was developed partly because we decided that we wanted to name ourselves. Colored and Negro were imposed names. Black was something that became particularly popular in the 1960s with the Black Power movement and the counterculture and things which in many ways were very good. My question is whether we needed something new in about 1988 when African American came along. And it seems to me that black does the same thing that I think African American was designed to do. African American is designed to give us a kind of pride and also to strike a certain poetic note of regret and remembrance, a sort of Shoah sort of thing compared to Jews. I think black had the exact same overtone. There was nothing wrong with it. And unlike African American, it didn't not make sense. And so I think we need to go back to black.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Joe Leslie's on the phone. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What are you thinking?
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what are you thinking? I'm curious.
Well, I'm concerned because I like to see myself as politically correct. But when I talk about someone's description of what they look like versus their culture, there should be a difference. I want to be comfortable when I describe somebody, not having to be so politically correct and being able to say they're blonde-haired or they're dark-skinned.
How do you describe yourself, Joe Leslie?
Am I white? No, I'm not white. I would love to see, and I know this is not real, but it's a dream. People describe each other by their appearance, not necessarily what their great-great-great-grandfather or great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was. So My comment is that if we could move to seeing each other not as the same, because we're not, but allowing people to describe each other in a way that's more holistic. Someone is dark-skinned, someone is light-skinned, someone is of African descent, that's okay. But I don't like tiptoeing around a term that's politically correct and having to worry that I'm just saying the wrong thing.
There was, though, John McWhorter, a time when, and maybe it's still a part of being judgmental of other people, where to say, I'm not black, but I'm light-skinned black, or I'm fair and I'm black. And, these were ways of trying to establish that. And While I get the principle of what Joe Leslie is driving at, the direction she's offering, I'm not sure about that.
Well, I understand what she's saying, and I hope that in 100 years, maybe 75 years, that's where we are. But there are some wounds that are very fresh, and we have to deal with our present reality. There was a famous experiment where small black children were shown to prefer white dolls. It's been replicated, and things were the same not too long ago. There is a certain stain at the heart of the African-American soul. It's still there, and that's part of why there there are names like African American, where there's a sense that in order to have pride, we have to do something special. We have to throw some salt over our shoulders. We have to remind ourselves of Africa. And so in the same way, nowadays, many African Americans or black people, from now on, I'm going to start calling us black people again, are uncomfortable when a black person says, well, I'm part Indian, or, well, I'm not going to call myself black. And that is based on insecurity. There's a sense that that person is saying that they're better than you, which could only come from somebody not being proud of being black. All of that is inevitable, given our history. And that means that we're not going to be able to have those sorts of holistic descriptions for a while. It'd be nice. We're working on it. But right now, we're in a transitional period, and that's always the hardest kind of period to be in.
But isn't there still in society, in this society at this time, a certain sort of pejorative tag attached to the use of color? Certainly if you step away from black and say she is yellow-skinned or he is red-skinned or brown-skinned, that doesn't carry with it any of the sort of communal pride that the word black does. And I'm wondering if you run the risk of stepping back from African American to going in that direction at the same time. Am I making myself clear?
I think so. It's good to have a term of pride. Ultimately, we would like to view ourselves as individuals, I think. The emphasis we have these days on group identity is problematic, and people in the future are going to look back on the period we're in now and see it as a fetish of ours, although it feels so normal to us. But if we're going to have that kind of group identity, and we are, nothing anybody writes or says is going to get rid of it, we have to fashion our individualities just in our own homes, we are groups in public, then I just say that, yeah, we need a term. It's not that black people shouldn't call themselves anything, but they should call themselves black. There was nothing wrong with that. It was a proud term. And African American is clinical, it's clumsy, it's not accurate, and it implies that my actual ancestors, who I care about, didn't matter.
I think you and I saw the same newspaper article about the Ethiopian-born activist who found he was in a group of black people, and they were saying, no, this is an African American issue, it's not your issue. And he was going, wait a second, I'm African American. They were saying, no, you're not an African American. Mm-hmm. If you make the shift.
The very next day, I wrote my op-ed in the L.A. Times. That article made me almost physically ill.
Just because of the way that he was being pushed away by the others.
Mm-hmm. Because I've met men like him, and I thought, that's it. This has got to stop. If it's gotten to the point that this makes the Times, then somebody needs to say something about this. And so far, a lot of people have agreed with me.
Yeah, I actually read a series of letters in the L.A. Times where people were saying, proper thing, as it should be. And I'm just wondering, what happens to the name black in that context? That way, that means that this Ethiopian-born activist is black, you're black, this distinction of where your parents come from, that Colin Powell's folks were from Jamaica, rather, you know what I mean? It's just, are you
black
doing away with all of that?
Well, black is more inclusive. If we're all African American, then we get into the painfully obvious fact that descendants of slaves in America are not meaningfully African at all. I mean, it takes a scholar to identify how the working class black man in Cincinnati is African. It doesn't take a scholar to identify how somebody who grew up in Ethiopia is African. Black, on the other hand, leaves out the Africa part in terms of what's actually in the word, and it makes a kind of reference to skin color, and then there's also a historical connotation. And so black was always a graceful umbrella term. The Ethiopian guy is black, the working class black man in Cincinnati is black, and there's no problem with it. African American doesn't fit gracefully in that way. And so I think it's time for us to get comfortable with what was working.
Did it have its moment, African American?
Sure it did. I mean, the journalists at this point are required to use it. I have found that in my own writing, black sometimes gets corrected to African American. People have laboriously learned to use it as a kind of conditioned reflex. It's been quite successful. I'm a linguist, and linguists study, among millions of other things, black English. That, in the linguistics industry, is now called African-American Vernacular English, and that has become an abbreviation or an acronym that people pronounce. It's called, believe it or not, what is known in the public as Ebonics in the linguistics world is called AV, which is African-American Vernacular English. So it's really caught on, but it doesn't make any sense. And I want to go back to a term that really celebrates what I am, and I am not a Sierra Leonean.
The name of the commentary that John McWhorter wrote is Why I'm Black, Not African American. It has woken up that debate about how you use names and labels and which one works as either one better than the other. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialists now providing help for all your computer needs and services. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The forecast today, look for some more scattered showers, otherwise mostly cloudy. Maybe a little bit of sunshine with highs in the mid-70s. Mostly cloudy, foggy, and humid tonight, lows in the lower 60s. Variable cloudiness tomorrow, warm and humid. Scattered showers with high temperatures in the upper 70s. Right now, 66 in Boston.
WBUR supporters include Bloomsbury, publishers of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, Susanna Clarke's new novel set in 1806 war-torn England, where a master magician and his pupil emerge to change the course of history. Innuendo, presenting the new Hunter Douglas fall introductions, including new duet features like cordless top-down bottom-up, on display in the Hunter Douglas Window Fashions Gallery. Innuendo and North Hill, a Greater Boston life care retirement community in Needham, offering independent living apartments, home health, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation for 19 years. 781-433-6526.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. And if you spend any time in chat rooms and looking at streams of conversation, you'll see that an essay written by the linguist John McWhorter entitled Why I'm Black, Not African American has prompted a lot of debate about the use of those terms and their appropriateness and the time that they come in. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you in on that conversation. We should do a little bit of history here. Go back to a meeting in Chicago, 1988. Okay, that's 16 years ago. And it was a meeting at that time of influential black leaders. When the meeting was over, they came out, and the best known among them, Reverend Jesse Jackson, took to the microphone and said, you know, it's time we started using the term African American. And since that time, a lot of people have been using African American. Reverend Jesse Jackson is joining us on the phone now from Atlanta, Georgia. He's currently president of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Reverend Jackson, thanks for your time.
Good morning, and good morning to Dr. McWhorter.
Hi, Reverend Jackson.
I'm wondering if you still stick to African American with the same determination that you did when you brought it out of that meeting in Chicago back in 1988.
Probably even more so. You know, I certainly did not originate the concept. For a long time, many Africans that struggled to maintain our root connection with the mother continent, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, for example, never broke the linkage. For so long, it was illegal for us to even maintain the linkage to Africa. And thus, we, through the movies and art, endeavored to learn to look disparaging upon African roots, upon our African selves. The fact is that our African roots are unbreakable. They're global, they're historical, and they're illegal. It is an experience that we cannot get around. Now, some people, like Tiger Woods, for example, say he's calibration because his father is African and his mother is Asian. And there's some degree of variation. But when you come from the African Brazilian, African Caribbean, African American, we with African roots, we're just one boat stop away from Africa. And what I find to be rather fascinating is that the other ethnic groups that come to our country, being the Jewish people still very much to their services in Hebrew, or the Irish Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the other ethnic groups tend to maintain a real connection to their roots.
I'm going to step back and let John McWhorter carry his own argument here. But just before I do that, one of the things that you didn't hear earlier in the program, Reverend Jackson, was John McWhorter saying, "Look, his proper name is John Hamilton McWhorter V. He is the fifth in a in a line of McWhorters who have all lived in America, and that the link to Africa that you're saying is so important is not that important to him.
Well, our generation, maybe not to him, but, you know, we speak of Jesus being the 42nd generation from David. Five generations, given our situation, is a lot of generational connection, but our roots are deeper than five generations. You know, 1619-1865 is 246 years. For us, it was an idea, interbellic period. We were totally disconnected, except by skin complexion and circumstance. And then another 1865, except the short interlude to 1965, we lived in a legal racial supremacy. So 246 years of legal race supremacy, where for much of that time it was illegal for us to marry, to give our children their names. We live with so many gaps, and so it has had a profound impact upon us psychologically. And some people refer to themselves even today as colored, some Negro, some Black. I'm not offended by any of those names, frankly. It's just I know that our global connection to Africa gives us a land base and an historical accuracy. It does not start just with skin complexion.
John McWhorter, I want you to jump in here.
Well, I understand everything Reverend Jackson is saying, and some of these things are just a matter of where you draw the line. But I don't see Black history as the complete tragedy that I think some people do. Yes, there was slavery. Yes, there was segregation. But what amazes me is that we fashioned the Civil Rights Revolution out of that. And I also think that, yeah, there was Plessy v. Ferguson, but there was Ida B. Wells. There was Frederick Douglass. There was W.E.B. Du Bois. There was Thurgood Marshall. It makes me uncomfortable that we're going to take this sort of flyover of all of that history and to say that, to have any kind of sense of roots or comfort, that we have to go back to Sierra Leone because of this biological connection. Africa's interesting. In my academic work, I've studied our linguistic relationship to Africa. African languages are very interesting. I've been to Africa three times. But my roots are in Philadelphia. And when I think about what I'm connected to, I think of a black and white picture of somebody with their hair parted down the middle and a mustache at the turn of the century going to their job as a cook in a silent film, hypothetically, in Philly. I don't feel like that's not enough. And I really just don't genuinely feel it when I think about Kunta Kinte. It's been too long. It's intellectual. It's academic. But I can understand how somebody might feel differently.
I'm not sure, John, that we start. I guess it starts at the beginning of the century. I mean, there's an African burial ground, as you know, in New York. And in part, that African burial ground is what makes us creditors and not debtors in this country. The commodity exchange was built upon us as the commodity. Wash was built upon trading us, importing Africans and exporting product. Those roots of our foreparents are too real for us to bury them deeper than they are. 1619 to 1865 is reality. It's 246 years of slavery, unlike any other immigrant group that came here. And the Civil War, critical to the Civil War, you know, was our roots. You know, often, if I might say this in a diversion, the Statue of Liberty is often thought of as some symbolic expression reaching out to Europeans to come to America. Actually, the French gave America that gift as a congratulations to ending slavery. That America qualified to be a Statue of Liberty once it ended slavery. We're right in the center of all of that stuff. And from 1865 to 1896 to 1954, the rather unbroken history. You can't celebrate the 54 Supreme Court decision without celebrating the 335 years of legal race supremacy that led into it. So why break our historical continuity?
Reverend Jackson, though, if we go back to the 1960s and to the transformation that was made in that decade from black being just a word that described color to being a word that was linked with pride, what's wrong with that going back there?
Well, you can go back there, but you have to go back much further than that. And we're not just white and black and brown and yellow and red. Those are descriptions of us. But there's a there's a legal history here. Let's just stop there for a moment. I mean, from 1619 to 1865 was legal slavery. Then from there to 1896, the law separate but equal by race. From there to 1954. I mean, I don't think we should be willing to break up how we have overcome. I look upon it as positive in that we're overcoming, but the gaps today between infant mortality and shorter life expectancy is all rooted in a history of supremacy and violations.
I understand all of that, but with all due respect, I sincerely don't understand what the connection between all of that is and Ghana. I mean, those people who are our ancestors survived. And to me, it's a miracle that they did, and they made our lives possible, particularly mine. But they were Americans. They were a kind of American. They were a black American. They spoke English. They were Christian. They wore Western clothes. Their music was not something that developed in Africa. There are no blues in Africa.
They learned to speak English, but the Africans in Brazil learned to speak Portuguese. And some in the French-speaking countries learned to speak French. We learned to speak the language of the country that we arrived in. The reason why people like Kenneth Clark, late Kenneth Clark, who was a key factor in the 54 Supreme Court decision from the island, and Stokely Carmichael and Bayard Rustin and Harry Belafonte and Cicely Tyson and Pardier, Sidney Pardier, they're from the islands, but they know that we're just a boat stop apart. We come from the same shared history. And it does not begin on an arbitrary date as Americans. We have a history that predates America.
Reverend Jackson and John McCord, I want to just ask you for a quick pause here. We do have callers who want to join the conversation. A reminder that our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Boston. Stephen's been holding on the line. Stephen, what do you think?
Hey, Dick, how you doing?
Fine,
great
thanks.
Show. You always do a great job. Let me just say real quick. I think that as a white man, I've always been a little bit uncomfortable using the term African-American, unless there's a very strong connection between the individual and the continent and the culture. I consider myself Italian-American, but that's because my grandparents are from Italy. It's a defining characteristic for who I am. But at the same time, black has also always been a difficult term for me because it feels almost abrasive. It has sometimes a negative feel to it. So what I wanted to bring into the discussion is, what about the term colored? Not people of color, but, sort of like they used, maybe 40 years ago or 30 years ago, when they would say a colored man, a colored woman. Like my grandparents, my grandmother says all the time, oh, she's a colored girl. Now that's fallen out of use, and I think that's a very classy, positive term.
John McCord, do you want to start?
I would agree. Colored was actually the best one because it didn't have that slight hint of abrasion that black had. It didn't refer to what some people rather athletically fashion into being a negative term. There's the old argument that black is negative and white is positive. And it also allows for all the gradations of hue that black people are in reality. It would be ideally, I would go back to that, but unfortunately, it has an air of Plessy versus Ferguson about it, and we can't help it. It has such a history that we can't bring it back because of those realities. And it's the same thing for Negro. Really, black is the best of many options.
Plessy versus Ferguson is preceded by the 13th Amendment, 1865. That's preceded by the 1857 Supreme Court decision that African descendants have no rights to fight the bound respect, and that's preceded by 1776 that we're 3/5 human. And so the evolution of our struggle from 3/5 human by Constitution to a civil war in which our situation was critical to the various legal cases it just shows our evolution as a people. No one would ask Jewish citizens to stop using Hebrew in the synagogue. It connects them to 7,000 years of history of the Roman as opposed to the American Catholic Church, or the Irish Catholic Church, or Frank Sinatra, Italian-American. All ethnic groups, without any sense of offense to anybody else, identify with their roots.
But we don't have that connection anymore, and that's because of what slavery was like. But that's our reality. You know, we don't have an African language to use in church. And it would be nice if we did, but we don't.
Well, we do have to reckon. We may have lost the language, but we've not lost the appearance. The historical connection between Africa and slave trade and slavery and segregation and desegregation. All these struggles to get where you and I are today are the result of our people overcoming odds. And really, it should be seen as victory. It's victory for us all.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection. Next call from Hillsborough, North Carolina. Retina's joining us. Hi, Retina.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that most of the minority populations in America seem to have a label that includes some connection with a region outside of America or even in America. Like you have Asian Americans, you have African Americans, you have Native Americans. But I don't see as much this sort of a regional label applied to the majority population, the white or Caucasians. And somehow the implication for me is that the majority population has become some sort of the generic. It's the standard. And every other minority population has to be defined off this standard. So you have the Americans.
Retina, I'd be with you if in fact we were talking about, you know, the white people in America deciding what it is they wanted to call blacks and African Americans. But this is a debate that goes on in the, you know, Hispanic Latino community about what name do we think suits us best, in the same way that we're listening to John McWhorter and Reverend Jackson saying which name suits us best. I mean, people have a right to argue about these things, do they not?
Sure, but yeah, I mean, isn't the implication there, however, that that they use African American just like they use Asian American and Native American, that somehow it's different from just American?
And no, I get that. Reverend Jackson, the suggestion that when you have the hyphen in there, you're saying minority, not majority, perhaps in some minds less than rather than equal to.
You know, the issue of ethnic hyphens is so clear to many white Americans have dual citizenship, literally. Dual citizenship with Greece, dual citizenship with Israel and many other countries. That's even legal within our country. There's no shortage of whites who have the ethnic identification with their historical roots, and they take pride in it. I mean, I take pride in the African and the Native American connection, for that matter. The African-Americanness will not go away. It's here to stay. Some people like the generic expression that's identifying us by skin color. And it's all right. I mean, it even fits in poetry. But the historical connection with Africa, you know, in 1976, Brzezinski wrote a letter to Jimmy Carter, who was then president, saying that African-Americans should be discouraged from relating to Africa because sometimes the American political priorities and African Americans with African liberation struggles may not be the same. He was right. We fought against apartheid in South Africa. At that time, most white Americans identified with that regime. We did not. From Ghana and its independence down to South Africa, we identified with African liberations. American public policy was ultimately changed by the African American struggle. Such a kinship between us and Mandela, between us and Nkrumah. These are very real connections, and it's so historically solid. Let me say this, because I'm doing a rally with some African Americans and some white Americans here in Statesboro, Georgia, even as we speak now. I want to thank Dr. McWhorter first for his scholarship and his wrestling with what I consider a great issue of our time. I wish I could stay with all you guys longer, but I really must go now. And Dr. McWhorter, congratulations and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Reverend Jackson.
Reverend Jackson, nice to have you on. We've got just a minute before I have to take a break here. John, a quick word from you on whether or not that hyphen American signifies minority, less than. Does that trouble you?
Well, it does to an extent. And more to the point, I would completely understand it if it hadn't been so very long. The ancestor that I feel was John Hamilton McWhorter I. And that doesn't preclude us helping with African liberation movements. But who we are is American. It's been that way for a very long time.
Connection listeners, a chance for you to weigh in when we come back after the break. A reminder, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Black, African American. Difference between the two names? Does one matter more to you than the other? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
We're funded by...
You're listening to The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. About a week ago, the linguist John McWhorter wrote in the Los Angeles Times, "Since the late 1980s, I've gone along with using African-American for the same reason that we throw rice at a bride. Because everyone else was doing it. But no more. From now on, in my writings on race, I will be returning to the word I grew up with, which reminds me of my true self and my ancestors who worked here to help make my life possible. Black." Comes from an essay which is entitled "Why I'm Black, Not African American." We invite your response to that position. John McWhorter is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of a book called Authentically Black. To Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Quincy's on the line. Hi, Quincy. What do you think?
Well, good morning. It's a very interesting discussion, and I think I completely agree with Mr. McWhorter. I'm an American. My family's been in the country for about 200 years. I look white, but people always want to know what I am. My last name is Vail, and they say, you know, where did you come from? And I say, well, I came from New York City, or where'd your parents come from? And they came from New York and Brooklyn, and beyond that, from Chicago. I kind of think the question is an irrelevancy. Obviously, if I go back far enough, 200 years or more, I wind up in Prussia or Austro-Hungarian or something like that. And I feel no cultural connection to those cultures at all.
You don't want to be a Mongolian American.
Well, I actually do reply that I am Mongolian when I'm asked that question, because the people who settled Eastern Europe were Huns, who were Mongolians or Cossacks. If I knew where the Mongolians came from, I'd say I was that, but I don't have any more snappy answer than to say I'm Mongolian. And normally I just say, well, I'm an American, and, you know, you can leave it at that.
Quincy, where do you suppose this sort of conversational American quirk comes from, where people always want to know where someone's from, and that means getting beyond the people who arrived here in this country however many years ago?
I don't know what it is, because I don't ask people when I meet them where, you know, what their ethnic cultural background is. They're either nice or they're not nice. I like them or I don't like them based on, I guess, what Martin Luther King said, the content of their character. And I don't particularly care. My wife is black. I mean, I guess I don't even look at her that way. She has been in the country, and her family has been in the country for a couple hundred years. Her mother's Filipino. I just have a hard time understanding why this is interesting to people a lot of the time. Obviously, if someone is an immigrant and they have an accent or they have a different cultural background, I can ask them about that, or it's obvious from the conversation. But beyond that, I really don't ask. And, you know, if they want to tell me, that's fine. But it normally doesn't even come up in conversation.
John, why does it matter? Why do people ask?
I think that a lot of the reason that it matters is because all of us as human beings like having a way to feel special. And I think that the kind of the obsession with ethnicity and the creation of new ethnicities in a way that we've seen, particularly over the past 40 years, it taps into the fact that it feels good to have something to say about yourself that is different from everyone else. And so our whole diversity fetish, in a way, is all about celebrating the fact that we're not like each other. And that's a fetish of our society now. It wouldn't have made sense to somebody 100 years ago. It won't make sense 100 years from now. But the African-American idea is part of that. When you say you're African-American, it feels special. You end up being connected to this exotic, faraway continent. And the whole hyphen American issue is based partly on that. But unfortunately, in feeling special, we also often end up feeling apart from others. And I think that's the last thing our society really needs. And so it's a fashion which I hope will pass. Ultimately, we do want to just be Americans and individuals. Ironically, the tenor of our times is such that people who used to not be considered valid individuals now have a way of resisting being thought of as individuals themselves.
Why? What exactly do you mean? What's changed? I'm not following you here.
It used to be that, for example, with black Americans, the idea was don't judge me by the color of my skin. The idea was judge me by the content of my character. We're all the same inside. Nowadays, often, if a white person does do that with a black person and doesn't pay attention to the color of their skin, that's considered a social faux pas. The white person is not acknowledging that person's individuality, their separate identity. And I think that the reason we've gotten to that point is because there is a kind of tick in our society, which is to seek to set yourself off in some way from other people, often with a grievance. We are a grievance culture, and that's not only black people, that's everyone. It gets magnified in black America because of our experience. And so it's just ironic that it used to be that we were supposed to get beyond skin color, and today many African Americans would prefer that it always be kept front and center. I think the name African American taps into that sentiment, and that's part of my discomfort with it.
I want to go back to the phones, to Boston now. Mike's on the line. Mike, getting beyond skin color, is that something that you think we should try to do in the way that we name people, each other?
I think that as long as America maintains a pretty rigid caste system based on race, which I would argue they still do, I think it's actually really irresponsible to talk about moving beyond skin color. Because I think that if skin color is determining very real, like, socioeconomic realities for people in their day-to-day lives...
Yeah, but aren't you just perpetuating that, though?
I would argue no. I think that oftentimes labels or identifications like black or African-American or whatever certain communities want to identify with allows them to form more collective identities that can actually much better challenge these institutions as opposed to trying to challenge them as individuals. But my question would be, because I actually agree with everything that the Reverend is saying, but my question would be if black could be reclaimed as a title that actually acknowledges the much more diasporic reality of the slave legacy.
I wonder if it doesn't already. I mean, I don't hear black used anywhere outside the United States with that same attachment, John, that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting. What the previous caller said is just based on differing politics. I respect what he's saying, but I don't think that there's a race-based caste system. I don't think that black people's main problem is what is often called institutions. I think that there's a serious problem with a segment of the black community who've been left behind. And with all due compassion, I don't think that it was the system that created that. It was the very seismic cultural developments from 1960 to 1970 that waylaid a lot of people. And that's not blaming the victim, but it's a different analysis. That's the subject of my next book, but
okay,
it's understandable.
But there was a ton of research, two years ago, that said if you went through the hiring logs of American corporations, that the people with the name like, you know, Tarika got a whole lot fewer callbacks than Lucy or John. And
oh, sure, sure.
I mean, that's
evidence,
is it not, of some kind of race-based caste system in the country?
I wouldn't call it a caste system. That does happen, and it's just a matter of degree. And so, for example, there was a time when the person applying for that job had no hope of getting the job at all, whereas that study showed that, yes, there are those statistical tendencies. So certainly I'm not saying there's no racism, but I believe that it's at the point where that racism is not a serious obstacle to success. The problems now have changed. There will always be some racism in society. It seems to be genetically programmed into human nature. That's not fair, but it's also true. But I think that we do tend to be distracted by a notion that until all racism is gone, black success is a fluke. And that's just not true. That's something we've been taught for 40 years. But actually, I think our problems today, and there are problems, are more complicated. And it all kind of ties into the name issue as well, because I don't look at black history in this country as bleak as a lot of people do. And a lot of that's just based on the lens that you look at these things through.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Next to Wayland, Massachusetts, Mimi's on the line. Hi, Mimi.
Hi there. I just wanted to make three comments. One is I'm very offended by classifications, and when I get the census and it asks me what my race is, I always check human. Second point I'd like to make is that most blacks in this country have a lot of white blood in them. Over the 200 years or more that they were here, their white masters were very involved. The third point...
What does that have to do with it, though? Are you saying that people can't call themselves black?
Of course they can. Absolutely they can. But I'm saying I don't understand why someone is black rather than white. If, like Obama recently, he feels he's black, but he's half white. So
go on, then.
Yeah, that's my second point, and I get a little nervous talking on but I'll...
You're doing great. Go ahead.
Okay, my third point is that when my son was in the first grade, he's dark-skinned, he's, quote, Caucasian, we're Jewish, and there was another little boy who was a black boy, quote, and he was an albino, and he had red, curly hair. His skin was whiter than my son's. The teacher had them up at the front of the class, and she was trying to make an issue that color doesn't count. And that's my comment.
So did it work?
Well, I don't know, but my son came home and told me about it, and I thought it was rather amusing. I didn't think it was fair to put both of them in the front of the room and make a point about their skin color. That's all I have to say.
Can I ask you, though, just before you leave, though, Mimi, if there's an argument going on in the American black community that African-American or black is the better term, are you happy having that decision made by black Americans? They say, look, we're black or we're African-Americans. That's fine. Okay, I'll go with that if that's what you want.
I think that everybody has to do that for themselves. And just as these two people have a difference of opinion, they can call themselves what they feel they want to be called. And when I was a little girl, I had never seen a person other than white people. And then one day I saw somebody and I was introduced to that person as this person is colored. And that was the first time I had ever heard a term other of any discrimination other than American Indians.
Mimi, I thank you for your call. I want to go shooting straight across to Raleigh, North Carolina. And Byron's with us. Hi, Byron.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. What are you thinking here?
Okay, I was thinking when I was 12 years old in the eighth grade, all the history up until that time about America always started with the black experience being slaves. And by the time I was 12, that had bothered me so much, I just figured that there had to be more to our history than just starting all of a sudden popping on the globe as slaves. So once I started learning more about my history and my African roots, the term African-American meant so much to me as a regular American because... As a regular American, it appears that we became slaves and then we were freed, which our history was so much richer than that. And if I had a choice to associate myself with a culture or history, it would be the rich history and culture of Africa.
John, go ahead.
I completely understand that, but my response is just that Africa was too long ago. You can only do that in an academic sense. We don't have the language. We don't have the folkways. We don't have the dress style. We don't know any of our African ancestors. And more to the point, our history wasn't only slavery. There were other black people who were free. There was an abolitionist movement. There were many black heroes. Starting after Reconstruction, there were thriving black business districts all over the country where you could get anything that white people could get in their districts. There was, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution. We created ragtime, blues, jazz, and rock and roll. The idea of looking back and only seeing the slavery is, again, kind of part of our times. We have a great deal to be proud of right here that we can really feel in the language that we speak. So I don't think we need to look to Africa for pride. We need to have pride in something, and we've done an awful lot of wonderful things right here.
Byron, last word to you.
I was going to say that, but the contrast that when you learn about white history, you always learn about the Americans when they were Europeans and since the Middle Ages and how they evolved into Americans. And so I think it should be the same way for African Americans also.
What do you think of the word black?
I like the word black. In my travels, meeting black people around the world, I started using the term black myself just to identify myself with the struggles of the people in Sudan and the people in Jamaica who consider themselves black, not Jamaican Africans, only African Jamaicans. So I myself use the term black to identify myself with the struggle of black people worldwide.
So they both work.
Right. They both work.
Byron, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
John, could you hope for anything better than that?
It's certainly something that I understand. And having compassion for people around the world is important. But I just think that when we're dealing with our own backyard, I thought that black was good and that we don't need to pretend to consider ourselves Africans to like ourselves.
John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
John McWhorter, linguist and senior fellow in public policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. Earlier in the program, a chance to hear the other point of view on black versus African-American with Reverend Jesse Jackson, senior president of the Rainbow Push Coalition. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.